like to welcome all of you here, especially the group from GH Billiton in South Africa. Today we're discussing the role of business in promoting the ideals of South African foreign policy. As you know, we had a session yesterday with Vodacom and the Center for Conflict Resolution. So this is a continuation of that seminar. I think we ought to get started so we can finish on time. Please carry on.
You can hear. Thank you very much. I would say many thanks, Madam Chair and Honorable Member. Let me begin by again reiterating my personal apology that I was not able to participate yesterday. We were looking forward to this. But I'm also delighted that my colleague, Bronwyn Wilkinson, was able to be here the whole of yesterday so that the net effect is that as a company, we would have benefited from the deliberations yesterday and today. We recall our presentation to you last year and how much we benefited from the wisdom of this honorable committee, and we come in that spirit again, looking forward to tap on your wisdom and experience. This is something I'm required by company protocol. We don't need to go through all of it. All it means is if on the basis of my presentation you buy our shares and the stock market crashes tomorrow, I should not be personally held responsible. Just to give a sense of where we are, you will notice we are in every continent, and like rugby, very strong in the south of the hemisphere, South America, Southern Africa, and Australia, quite strong, and a few pockets in the developed world. Altogether, about 26 countries and 120 operations throughout the world and growing. In petroleum, energy, coal, metallurgical coal, manganese, iron ore, aluminium, base metals, diamonds and specialty projects and stainless steel, prominently absent in our portfolio is gold. By any measure, we are the largest resource company in the world by market capitalization. A quick translation there shows that our market cap has exceeded 1 trillion rand. In the top five, it's evident. Two major South African companies, or South African companies with South African roots, BHP Billiton number one, and also Anglo American quite strongly at number five there. And the combined market cap of these two companies is enormous indeed. But also by world standards, we are quite a major company also in the world. Beyond resources. This is a very, very key slide. The printing is very small and we will not go into detail. But when we call creating sustainable value, that is actually the core, the guiding principle of our operations and our philosophy. And we want to also believe that particularly on the continent, it proved to be a major competitive advantage, because we found on the continent, and I'm sure in this country, it's not enough to demonstrate that you are a financial success, that you are a commercial success, but the major premium that you also have to pay is to demonstrate that you are a major social success, and we will demonstrate it with some of our properties. And the key philosophy central there is the philosophy of zero harm. If you notice every financial statement of BHP Billiton, it starts on the number of casualties. And zero harm is so central that is the only issue. The minute there is a casualty in your operations, you know that not only your bonus, but that of the chief executive and everyone is actually reduced. And we have, wherever we have performed, where we came down, it would be because of the number of casualties. Last year in the region, we had 3, and we knew it involved a major shakeup in the company as a result of that. I always say when I get a call on Sunday afternoon from a colleague, my biggest nightmare is don't tell me anybody has died, because I know I'm in very, very serious trouble. And this, our health, safety, environment, and community governance, these are very, very critical protocols for us. We have systems and documents governing our health, safety, environment, and community protocols. I will not go into detail now, but underlying that is that zero harm to our communities, zero harm to the environment, zero harm to and the safety and the health of our employees, and also the environment. It's very, very critical, very, very detailed in our document, and management and staff have to sign every year that they are aware of this protocol. But most importantly, they apply with similar intensity, both in London, Houston, and Middleburg. When it comes to these issues, we do not have African standards, Asian standards, and European standards. They apply across the board. It presents challenges, but that certainly is the case. As I said, sustainable development is fundamental, both as a competitive value, but also as an ethical imperative. Increasingly everywhere in the world, your license to operate depends entirely not only on your financial success, but on a whole range of other values that underpin sustainability. If I have the opportunity, I will elaborate, but increasingly for us, this record has made us a preferred partner of choice with many African governments, based on our track record on this, and we are very proud of it. This record has also enabled us, it has put us in a better position to attract skilled and motivated workforce. And it's very, very interesting. We are at a point where we receive approaches, more approaches than we send out in a search of staff, and this is something we believe in. We have a reputation as an ethical company, and again, I'm sure you have heard this many times and you wonder what is new here, but that reputation is very strong, particularly on the continent as we continue. It's not propaganda when I tell you we do not pay bribes. We have never paid them. And the funny thing is that has put us in a better position than those who do these things, because the world, and South Africa in particular, is very ruthless on these things. You may do them now, but they will emerge at some point in your history. And we find that in a new especially on the continent, when new governments come in, they begin to dig and investigate these deals to find out what went wrong there. And our experience is, in the short term you lose, in the long term you win. Obviously, members will understand I'm not at liberty to give concrete examples, but there were cases where we were excluded precisely because we did not pay an additional fee. And 3 years down the line, we were actually re-invited on the same terms that we wanted on clean hands, and we are very proud of that. I will come back to this not largely as a sustainability issue, but as an issue South Africa needs to be very, very aware of. This slide distinguishes us from everybody else. It gives you a sense of how many projects we are busy with right now. Important and some substantial part of them on the continent. And why I say this is important for us as a country, well, for us as an industry, no other company would match us on the number of projects we have in the pipeline. But for the country, we wouldn't be having so many projects in the pipeline unless we were very, very confident about the outlook for mining in the world. We believe that China alone represents the kind of industrial revolution we haven't seen before in the last 50 years or so. It's happening, and the consumption of resources in China will continue. If you add Russia, India, and Brazil in the mold, it simply means you are looking at about over 20 to 30 years of sustained growth in the resources. And it means that companies which are at countries that are endowed with resources like South Africa, with appropriate public policy, public interest policies, and encouragement of industry, times cannot be better than they are now. And this is very, very important. But you can see as a company, we are positioned way up till beyond 2020 to be able to take advantage of this boom in resources. And a number of the projects here, we give them strange names. Some of them are in South Africa. We are busy right now in South Africa on a very, very exciting project of gas exploration on the West Coast. Now, that's a dream project for any company because you do not have to worry about how you export that gas. It's required here and now at home. So it becomes a very, very inexpensive project. We are just busy with the Treasury Department to finalize issues around taxation. And once that is done, we think it is going to be the next major investment by us on the West Coast. We have already got licenses on Namibia. And it will just be the same continuation of the same processes there. We are looking at massive coal expansion in Middelburg. This is going to our board for approval in January. We hope this will come. But lots of them very, very strong. Some of them very strong on the African continent. And the ones that are put here are those that we can afford to talk publicly, that there are more still coming. This is where we are on our home base. Coal largely around Mpumalanga, Witbank, Middelburg. We used to have strong coal deposits in what is now KwaZulu-Natal, long before that. But now we are concentrated in Mpumalanga. Large deposits of manganese in the Northern Cape. Aluminium in Richards Bay and also in Mozambique, and also partnerships also in Richards Bay with the mineral sands, and as I also mentioned, looking very strongly on the West Coast with gas exploration, and if everything goes well, we hope to announce it before end of the year. publicly, the public information we are able to share now is that we are busy in 10 countries on the continent. We are busy in more than 10, but we are not yet in a position to talk about. What is interesting here, a very key country for us is the DRC, where we are busy with the diamonds and copper, we are exploring very strongly, and Guinea with aluminium. And members may have noticed that last week we announced that we have financed a feasibility study of the Inga 3 energy on the Congo. What is interesting about the capacity of the DRC power is that once developed, it can actually look after the whole of sub-Saharan Africa. And we believe that if that can be exploited, it is actually going to change the economics of sub-Saharan Africa. It is going much slower, not surprisingly, because it involves the whole of SADC. And where you have more than one government, I don't need to remind members, things tend to be very, very slow. But we are in the middle of all of that, and we have invested on risk quite a major sum to push the feasibility of the Inga. And if we are successful, it is going to change. But just to give you an indication of potentially what it can mean, bauxite in Guinea is used for aluminium, and at the moment there's no bauxite in South Africa, and we get our bauxite from Australia. Now, if our Guinea project is successful, it means we can cut our transport costs by getting our bauxite from Guinea. But most importantly, that bauxite can now travel all the way on the west coast and come to Richards Bay and Mozambique, where our smelters are. But you don't need to return empty boats. You can get the boat stopping in Richards Bay, collecting coal in Richards Bay, and taking it back to Guinea. And if you do that, you are now able to build a smelter in Guinea with the coal that you have there. And that would be a very unprecedented case of intra-Africa trade of beneficiated material. And I haven't even mentioned about what could also happen between the power in the DRC and the power in Guinea. And all I'm pointing out is we take a very, very long-term view of this project, because we do believe they will change the political and economic equation in the company, and I mean on the continent. And as a company, we can only benefit, and so do other people. How do we link with foreign policy? Madam Chair, members will recall that last year I did submit that I really do not think we have even begun between government and business. We have even begun to explore the synergies that we can do before that, I mean on those. Very quickly, this is our understanding of the focus of the key principles of South African foreign policy, stated there: peaceful, democratic, and stable continent. Let me tell you, no company wants to operate in the middle of war, so that one does not even restate. If anything, it is a condition for doing business. Promotion of human rights. Again, I'm still waiting for a company which would want a dictatorship in this day and age. Justice and international law, very, very interesting, probably the most critical issue for business, because when you move anywhere as a business, the first thing you want to guarantee on is that your contracts are with the paper that are written on. So the rule of law is absolutely critical to business. Promotion of interest of Africa in world affairs. Totally in agreement. If I could add to that, is that our assessment, certainly in the industry in which we operate, of resources within the continent has only been exploited to about 30% of its known resources, so the potential for upscale is very, very high. Economic development, again, very clearly, no company wants to operate in a country that is getting poorer and poorer. What our values, I have indicated them earlier, safety and the environment, again, we still want to come across a government for which this is not important at all. We are a high-performance company. We are excited about everything we are doing. When we signed the contract in the DRC last week, it's just a pity that alcohol is not allowed on our premises. Otherwise, we would have been at an exciting day and night. By integrity, we don't mean we are holy. We simply mean whatever we said we will do, we are going to do. Our weight is very, very important to us. Win-win relationships. We have learned that as business, we would be completely out of our mind if we could only worry about our interests and ignore governments and communities. And whatever we do, we want to make sure that there is alignment with public policy issues and also community issues. We are very courageous when we have to take responsibility for delivering positive change in the face of adversity. We are very strong and we have a strong culture of mutual respect. What has been our key partnership as a company, foreign policy? We are an active member in the EU-ACP joint parliamentary sitting, and we participated in Edinburgh and also in Vienna. And here, Chair, I would like to place on record our appreciation to the government of this country through the support we received from the ambassador in Brussels, Ambassador Suklal. He has really facilitated our role in this important body and has shown active interest both with us, and we were very proud to celebrate our National Day last year with him in recognition for the role and support he has given. In the SADC, very, very active, and I remember 2 years ago we were invited by the then minister, now deputy president, to come and take almost a strong position with the South African government on energy issues in the region. And we have welcomed that opportunity as one of the win-win situations. We have strong relations with Commissioner Louis Michel in Brussels, and he has championed our case, particularly on the DRC and on other issues that I will talk about. We have now formed an EU-Africa Business Forum, and I'm one of the 2 co-chairs there, and we have found again that bringing the synergies of the continent and of the 2 continents, Europe and Africa, has helped us as a company. And in December, I've been invited to present to that summit in Lisbon again in December. Yeah. But the key point of our partnership, really involving our own country, has been what happened in the DRC. And again, we are indebted to the former ambassador who was here, who guided us through all the political landmines, and who worked very, very closely with us and the South African government and the DRC. I mean the DRC government and also the DRC ambassador in Pretoria. And it was on the basis of that support that came directly from the Foreign Affairs Department that we were eventually able to sign the Memorandum of Agreement on the industry feasibility. I've already talked about it, but the hand of the South African Ministry and Department of Foreign Affairs was not invisible in this case. When we had the Guinean ministerial delegation to South Africa, the ministry involved us in those visits, and whenever I meet our foreign minister, she still inquires how we are going on some of those projects where she gave us the full support, and we took the opportunity to show them our operations, particularly in Mozambique. Again in Guinea, Ambassador Kekana has just been amazing from inception till end. We are doing very well, and we are now, we have 33 operating share in an aluminium refinery project. But in those two cases, the Department of Foreign Affairs was actively and directly involved, and we have found that a very, very encouraging role. Something I'm not proud to confess publicly, you know, as a Catholic, I only confess in private. I think we missed an important deal in West Africa because we did not communicate with our embassy on time. And the time we came in, the train had already moved on, and it was a very, very bitter lesson for us that we should have known that. A great story that the region does not know about. When we moved into Mozambique in the aftermath of a civil war, the malaria infection rate was about 98%, and children were dying, our employees were dying, let alone the communities. And a very deliberate partnership involving our government, Mozambique and Swaziland, with us as a company doing the operation, has actually reduced that infection rate by 90%. The reality is, as a company, we could not have done it on our own. Not a single government would have done it on our own, but it was again a good example of how foreign policy and the private sector work together in something that benefited communities directly. We cover about 100,000 square kilometers. And from that experience, we are doing a pilot program in Guinea because malaria is also a big issue there. I know we talk about HIV a lot, and I'm not going to undermine it, but malaria is something we cannot afford. It kills people directly and immediately, and we are in the middle of all of that. This is a propaganda story I can talk about the whole day. And Honorable Chair of this Portfolio Committee will recall that we have invited members of the Portfolio Committee at their convenience to visit Mozal, because we believe Mozal is just a living example of how business should do things. We don't need to give you propaganda. You need to look at it yourself, and you will insist this is the way to do business anywhere else. When we came there, there was absolutely nothing except the ravages of war. But right now, we have built a primary school, hospital, and at the moment, we operate an aluminium which is probably in the top three best in the world. But that is not enough. When we started that aluminium smelter, we started with 96% expatriates because there was nothing in Mozambique. Today it is run by 86% local people. I don't mean at the bottom, I mean real right to steel management. And it is, as I said, certainly within the top best in the world, the top three best in the world. And the lesson does not need to be retold, that living on this continent is no reason for sloppiness. And even out of the worst possible conditions where people's spirit to win, it's amazing what miracles can be achieved. And the third thing about Mozambique is that each time it moves 20 years ahead, some hurricane will come and set them back. But in terms of the achievement, in terms of government to work with, it's a pleasure for business to operate in that country, a real pleasure. We have put in about 14 billion South African rand in there in Mozambique. It is owned by us, Mitsubishi, and the IDC, and the government of Mozambique has 4%. I can go on and on, but I would rather you have the presentation. I would simply want to reiterate that I will say it without fear of contradiction, that anybody who sees our plan there will know that this is the best way that business should operate in the country. We can all, in any country, we can always improve, but we don't need to. Again, these are details you can look in our presentation. I've already realized that I expressed my freedom of speech beyond the reasonable basis. What we wanted to emphasize in this is that there is strong local business participation around our smelter, about 600 million rand, and we are spending on goods and services in local economy, and out of our smelter, we are using 170 active local suppliers, and we have added 10 in the last 12 months. And we think that has been our impact. Enterprise development, which is also a very key issue of legislation in this country. We have 25 companies participating in the modeling program. We have awarded 60 packages to local suppliers. Again, the message we are trying to put here is that local business has benefited from our present there. Look at the school above, that's what we found when we came there. No roof, electricity, water, when it's raining, no glasses. There were 130 pupils, grades only up to grade 5, 20% daily absenteeism due to malaria. What do we have today? Look in contrast again. This is what we had in 1998. This is what we have today. No roof, and look at what we have there. No electricity, we've got it. No water, we have it. No glasses when it's raining. Glasses take place when it is raining. We have sports fields. We have now 800 people. We have increased to grade 6 and 7. And total primary school, 6,400. We are busy building a secondary and an industrial school, and we have reduced malaria prevalence from 80% to 18%. It is too early to talk about Jimmy, but again, just to say we have moved in, we have just begun there, and we are already thinking of building an aluminium refinery, and the malaria program is underway. Summary, we believe that there are tremendous opportunities for collaboration. We think as a company we can promote investment in South Africa, not by actually preaching to people, but by actually continuing to invest here and growing. Nothing brings in, I still believe that the key impact on foreign investment is the behavior of companies in South Africa. We cannot tell foreigners to come in when we ourselves are reducing what we have in the country. They will never believe us. And we think the opportunity to expand what we have locally is very, very key. And we think we should begin to speak and reinforce together in a coordinated way values that are critical to government and to business. We can leverage global funding together on projects like infrastructure on the continent. And something that I believe we have not done very well, I have been on many state visits, either with the president or the deputy president But what I have found particularly lacking in these visits is a thorough briefing about what are the objectives of the visits, what is government looking for, and what should I as a business person do, what I'm there. And I think we are missing a lot of opportunity there. Simply focusing very clearly, if the president is going to China, I want to know what is it that the president wants to get out of that visit, and I want to get a very clear understanding of what role government wants me to play. I can't go off tangent on my own and start speaking on behalf of government. And I think this is one area where the portfolio committee can help us a lot in kind of tightening that alliance, because I'm quite sure, certainly on the part of VHP Billiton, but generally on the part of business, the spirit to support government in those areas is very, very high. Madam Chair, if you allow me, I would rather stop here. There are a few transparencies left, but I think my presentation gave sufficient background information that members will actually be able to understand where they are going. And once again, through you, Madam Chair, we would like to thank the Portfolio Committee for the opportunity you have afforded us to participate in this two-day seminar. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Pai. A very interesting presentation. We'll now open up for questions. So those of you who are interested in asking, I'm sure there are lots of questions and queries. You can do so now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you hear me? You can hear me. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Congratulations, sir. What a different experience from yesterday. I think yours is a confirmation of our government's position from 1994. There can be no transformation without the direct partnership between government, business, NGOs, civil society, perfect. The transformation can only take place in a concerted partnership in our country. But a similar thing occurs for us in Africa, and I want to direct the discussion towards Africa, because of great emphasis that we in government place on the resurgence and the renaissance of Africa. There are three or four minor issues that I'd like to raise, that while your focus areas are compatible with the foreign policy options of South Africa. What I'd like to find out from you, given that spectrum of activities, you have the capacity in historically and in the future to intervene creatively, not for the sake of business only. Our past experiences in Africa was business for business sake, trade for trade sake, and the rest can go to hell, if I put it bluntly. Mr. Pai, you have placed so much of emphasis on Mozambique. Your presentation does not make any reference. I guess I might be ignorant about this. What is Billiton's response to the surface coal, which runs into millions of tons in Mozambique, which have been ignored or mutilated, processed mutilated, because of the uneasiness at the hands of the Swakamas over the years? While you might be able to mine the surface coal there, what would be your response in respect to the transportation of that surface coal to the coast, especially now that you mentioned that there is a possibility for us in South Africa to export our coal in return for bauxite. That in respect of the expansion, as you said, in the coal industry, because of the resources that it has. What I would like to ask are two other questions. In terms of building synergies with the emergence of the international community's interest in Africa, because it is the investment destination for so many of the world's investors, from China on the one hand, to the European community on the other, and even in a limited way the Americans. How would you as a businessman or a militant would manage that? What would you say if the Chinese coming tomorrow, as they are coming in, and repeat the performance of the Trans Am Railway? The Trans Am Railway line was built, and not a single African person trained in engineering or the management skills of a railway line. What happened? What would be your response to that? Now, Mr. Pride, I'm going to ask you a tough one this time. This magnificent picture of diligence, we know, we are aware of this, and we just want to reflect as to what is the role of people like Billiton in the management of our foreign policy or in the execution of our foreign policy. In that context, what would you say, sir, is the role of the media? While this beautiful picture is presented by you in terms of the linkage and the spectrum that you have, the synergies that you seek, the vision that we have, is our media cooperating with the business sector? To what extent it is just a self-appointed, self-righteous critic of what government seeks to do and not achieve? Now, don't you think your story, ability, in partnership with the democratic forces of Africa, or anywhere in the world for that matter, should be a story told over and over again in terms of a partnership? I'm sorry if I'm placing you in a difficult situation in the last one, but it's important, I think.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, let me say that I'm traveling on Friday with and I think that they seem to have the real orientation for what is intended to be achieved by the foreign policy, looking at things like social success that you talked about, and the examples that you've given in Mozambique and so on. But I would like to know, as we go into investment in this country, from this country, what difference are we from those who come from outside and invest here or anywhere in Africa? And investment simply means they are there to make money. They are profit motivated. They have invested for years and years and years. They cannot look back and say whatever it is that's been left behind. I want to say, if you take a country like Ghana that became independent in 1957, doesn't look like there's any country in Africa that has been developed as a result of the kind of investment that was coming into Africa. And that is why I think that in the 21st century, when we talk investment, it must be a partnership, not of horses and riders, but a partnership of equals. In other words, investors must reap their profits, but the countries where they invest must also benefit in terms of economic development. Now, in this country, when we go and invest, starting with our own companies that go and invest, to what extent do we have the shares control? I mean, the shares that have been sold to the indigenous people. We go to Guinea. Just to what extent, in terms of shares, do they have? I would also like to know, in terms of wages, how different are we? Because I think this is one thing that we can promote this country, not only at official level, at official level, but the people in general would come to respect the country and feel that there for their good. I think that is all I'd like to say for now. I'm covered in a lot of other issues. But I just want again to say I'm impressed with the orientation. I'm only hoping that the implementation can be intensified.
Mr. Bande?
Thank you, Chairperson. Doctor, I'll just make it first of all, I'll start by commending with a small little message which is worrying me. It's in terms of the things which I saw in your screen about the EUACT. In its inception, I think I'm subject for correction, it was supposed to be ACT and EU, which means Africa, Caribbean, Pacific, and European Union. You know why I'm raising it? Why I'm saying it in inception? When it was created, it was signed in Cotonou, Benin, June 23, 2000. Most of the time, some of the initiatives by the Africans themselves, they are eroded as if they were brought by somebody else. And now we're doing the very same mistake. I think that was supposed to be corrected. Then come to the question. I don't know, I will start with one, which is like the second, about the issue of your role you should play in DRC. I was touched when we were there in DRC about the companies which are working there, but your involvement, because you indicated that involving diamonds and copper. What worries me, we deployed in Kasai region in Kananga, whereby we went to the provincial hospital. It was a shame and disgrace. The first aid kit we had as observer mission was better than the everything in the provincial hospital. And they are suffering in diseases, their challenges, including malaria, HIV and AIDS, Ebola and yellow fever. Therefore, what is your role as business people who are invented there, who are doing business there? And then also, come to an issue of Mpumalanga, of course, a serious concern in Mpumalanga. Of course, there are lots of resources locally. I'm subject for correction. I believe that each and every investor, whatever, is supposed to involve local people. I don't know. The business which we're talking about, do they take care of people, local people there? Except to be, I mean, opening a small tuck shop. I'll put an example. There is a gas pipe from Mozambique to Sasol. I can't believe whether local people were involved while it passed there. And then also with all these minings which are mentioning in Mpumalanga and Middelburg, Queensland, I'm from Desert. I don't know whether local people are taken on board, because most of the people are people from somewhere doing business while the local people are not involved. And the other one, there was a question yesterday about the issue of investment in the French-speaking countries. I believe we were facing challenges. Precisely, you mentioned something very good about the ASEAN, Caribbean, Pacific, and European Union. That there was an agreement which was signed concerning cooperation and partnership. I don't know which role can you play. What are you doing in assisting, helping the government so that we can make inroads in those particular countries? Last one. Officials sound very dubious to some people, while it's correct, it's a fact, about the issue of Zimbabwe. As business people, what role are you playing there in order to assist people in terms of uplifting their economy and also in particular for poverty alleviation and eradication? Why I'm raising it, we like it or not, Zimbabwe is part of SADC. We like it or not, the issue of Zimbabwe is affecting us, because a lot of people are running away in Zimbabwe, coming to this side. While I believe the solution is not to deport them. You deport them, you are playing. I've got an experience in Home Affairs. You deport them today, following day, you meet them there. They are back in South Africa. So the only solution is to create something there, so that they can be employed and stay there the way they're supposed to be. So, that is my last question, if maybe you can clarify us, except the wrong perception which is given by other people, as if you must take out Mugabe. No, I won't go deep on that details. Because you take him out or in, it's the same. The issue is policies and investment and how to develop the lives of the people. Thank you, Chairman.
The next person is Advocate
Matasa. Thank you, Chairperson. Of course, I have some feeling of deja vu when I see two of my former lecturers here, Keith and Mr. Mapai, who taught me political science at UWC. So it's a pleasure to have them at the same time. Mr. Mapai, I'm glad that you mentioned the issue of intra-African trade and beneficiation. I think for us that is a key issue. It's an interesting thing when you combine both of them. But those issues, whether combined or not, are very, very important, because the continent cannot move forward if there is no promotion of intra-trade. So if bulletin is playing a role there, we'd like to encourage that, and the issue of beneficiation. I'd like to come back to the issue that, if you remember last year, Honorable Member Gibson asked you, and he didn't want to be specific about it. He asked you the issue of the business forum, and you made certain suggestions. And even yesterday, when we had the presentation, this issue surfaced again. It seems to me there is a case, other than the business forum that involves government, just business alone. Business that is doing involving investments on the continent from South Africa. It seems that there is a case for such businesses to have a forum to share experiences, to learn from each other, best practices, and so on. I think that can go a long way to help other South African businesses to follow certain examples that you have presented. Another issue is this issue of coal. As you know, nowadays, correctly so, there is this issue of environment. And I haven't heard, perhaps I missed because I came a bit late, as to what is your company doing to deal with the issue, the challenge of environment in relation to coal. As much as it's a matter that we cannot move away from, because for us, the developing country and continent, we need coal and we have large reserves. So to develop, we need to use it. But there is pressure to either move away or to use it in such a way that is environmentally friendly. I think in line with your own principles of inclusive development and business, this is an important issue. The last matter is where you do business, especially outside South Africa, where you have mines and so on. I'd like to hear the working conditions of the workers. What is your company doing about that? As such an example, what I saw in Liberia, 2004, shocking. I thought we had very bad hostels in South Africa. The hostels I saw there, I couldn't believe. Those rubber plantations. There are shocking conditions, the size of the hostels and so on. So I'd like to hear what the region is doing with regard to working conditions, for example, housing and so on. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dr. Hassan. Let me add my words of congratulations to Dr. McFly. The overlap or lack of overlap between foreign affairs and trade and industry, how has that impacted on your ability to move and speed? There are issues of capacity. Our own capacity as a country in foreign affairs and international relations, how is that matched by our trading counterparts, and to what extent does that impact on them? The issues of regional bloc. This kind of footprint, how do you deal with the competing interests? Would be particularly interested in what your orientation is towards IFSA that is currently unfolding. Lastly, I see a reference to capacity development here, that number of engineers are in the reserve and so on. Dr. Ramgobin didn't hear the last thing, but I hope every other thing was heard. If I can just quickly restate, I wanted to check the core contribution of foreign affairs in the Department of Trade and Industry. I also inquired about capacity, our own capacity as a country, but how that compares with the foreign affairs services of other countries in which you trade, and if there are any discrepancies, how that impacts on your ability to move. Third inquiry was around the issue of trading blocks. With such a wide footprint, how do you deal with competing trading blocks? The last one was about capacity. Just how much capacity building is there from the, and also with the host countries. And in particular, we have a regime of black economic empowerment. From your South African springboard, how much of that regulatory compliance do you take into the other countries that you trade with? Thank you very much.
So when you decide to invest in a particular country on the continent of Africa, do you, does the country actually look at the NIPA program that exists in the country? The question to Dr. Pai is that when the DHB Bulletin decides to invest in a country, in a particular country in Africa, I see that there are three regions that they have emphasis on: the Southern Africa, West Africa, and I see two projects in North Africa. Do they actually look at the NEPRA program that may exist in these countries, and how would one be able to reconcile, if possible, to in fact take the program of NEPRA forward in that particular country? Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you very much, and in particular thanks to members for warm sentiments that have been expressed, and also for challenging comments and questions that you have put. I don't want to take them as a cluster from individuals, but rather as a cluster around the key theme. The first tragedy, if I could mention, that we haven't reached as a country, and I call it the failure of a country. We have never developed as a country a sense of common purpose. We don't. President Beni told us a very, very interesting story when he was sitting next to a business person on a flight, I can't remember from where, that was just at the aftermath of the fall of the wall in Europe. And he asked the businessman, well, what are you going to do? And the businessman, I'm just quoting it roughly, said to the president, I've been requested by the chancellor, it was in Germany, by the chancellor to go into what was Eastern Europe. There's an ailing company. He wants us to save that company in order to save jobs. And that is what this business person was doing. Now, let me tell you, you won't get that response from any South African business person who is being told to go to create a loss for your shareholders somewhere in the national interest of saving jobs. This is what I'm talking about. That without casting aspersion, we should see it as a number one failure of post-1994. That we have not identified issues on which we are going to stand together, regardless of political affiliation of an interest. I find this a worrying thing. In any other country, in the US, in the UK, business and labor will know when to close ranks with government. We don't have any of one of that. Why is it the case? Is it because government has failed to provide leadership? Is it because business is cynical and self-centered? Whatever the answer, unless we deal with this issue, a number of concerns raised by members today will not be addressed. Madam Chair, let me start with yours. You were asking, when we move into a country to invest, do we think of NEPRA? The honest answer is probably many business people don't know who NEPRA is. I don't say it proudly, but it comes from the point that I was making earlier, that we have not even learned to say, if you are in this country, these are 3 to 5 things, regardless of who you are, you should be committed to. And I think we need to correct that. Let me start with mining. How do you decide to invest? The first key decision is a geological decision. Is there gold? Is there platinum? If there's nothing, you don't even bother. That's the first thing. Is there something to mine? But the issues of where you link with government, they will be done by initiatives of individual leaders in business who actually know more about the politics of the country or not. But an average business people wouldn't even be thinking, what is NEPRA? Wouldn't even be thinking,
What are the regional imperatives here? And I think these are the gaps that I've been talking about, that without casting aspersions on one another, we need to find mechanisms where we must not confuse pursuing national interest with a form of centralism. The minute you talk about national something, everybody says you are a dictator, you are centralist, we should all be left in our own space, and yet we would be the first one to go to this centralist government when we need its help. So I think all of us have to clean up our hands, and I think what is required, government would need to tone down its rhetoric of sadly portraying business as an enemy. And business would require to tone down its rhetoric of sadly seeing government as a problem, as an obstacle between wealth and poverty. And I think if we can begin to stop labeling each other and identify our roles, because we have roles, all of us, and there are other roles we cannot play. And this leads me to the second question. Much as we are involved in countries, as business, we are aware that we are not government, and I don't at any point want to pretend to be president of Mozambique or of this country, because I'm going to chop my fingers. I know that. I will be playing in a game I do not understand. I'm not a politician, and I think that is why we have all of you here to run the country. It's not my job to run the country, any country in the world, but it is my responsibility to support the political leadership in doing a good job. And I think we need to be careful as business that there are certain areas we cannot take the front line because we are going to be chopped. We are not good at those kinds of games. So let me start a few specific questions. Issues of capacity. It's very, very interesting. People always talk of the politics of corruption, of all kinds of things as serious impediments to investment. I actually think the most serious problem in investment is actually capacity. Starting with our own country, which is the most developed on the continent, we just do not have the skills that we want. And worse than that, the tertiary institutions today are not actually geared to supply the kind of skills that the private sector needs. And on a few occasions, I have had to go into a joint venture with a foreign university because South African universities were telling them I'm violating their academic freedom. If I tell them this is what I need in the country, this is what I need for the company, can we sit together and put the curriculum together? No. Curriculum is the function of our professors. Don't violate our freedom our academic freedom. So capacity, it is a difficult problem, but in answer to the honorable member, any business that does not invest in its own capacity training, it's lost. We went through a phase as a world and as a country, we also went through that phase where we talked a lot about right-sizing and downsizing. We went through that phase. None of us anticipated the mining boom that we are seeing today. And by the time it came, all our engineers and so on were retrenched a few years ago, and that is the lesson that we have learned. So we do our own capacity by training our own staff. As I speak now, we are actually training engineers in South African universities from Guinea. The good thing about mining is from exploration to production, you have a leeway of about 10 years. And so we already have time to start building capacity for the staff that we need over there. It is a critical thing. But if I may, that's a very, very interesting note. There are two books that I found quite fascinating. One by an African scholar from Eritrea and the other one by a scholar from Stanford. And both of them were looking at the question, why is it that resource-rich countries tend to be the most underdeveloped? other members were asking, why is there poverty where there were so many mines and so on? You know, Kimberley is not as poor, as rich as a city where the diamond was. Then both of them actually come to one conclusion. They look at why Botswana was so successful and why the UK and Norway were so successful in the management of their oil resources. And they come to one conclusion that the success of any country is the function of the quality of its civil servants. Or they don't even say the politicians. They were saying it is the quality of the civil servants. If you capacitate the civil servants, governments come and go, but the civil servants are actually a continuity in terms of capacity building. And maybe this is something we need to begin. The Honorable Member raised questions about capacity and so on. And my sense is, from the point of view of business, don't listen to these stories that it is BEE, it is crime, it is that. All of those issues are serious. But it is going to be the speed and efficiency with which the civil service deliver. And a good example of that is when you deal with treasury. You tell them, I need this agency as business. They will tell you, give us 3 weeks. And I tell you, the response will come no later than 3 weeks. Even if it is to tell you, listen, we have run into a snag, but we are trying our best. And my sense is, if we can look at that speed of delivery and the high caliber of the civil service, it was the caliber of our ambassadors in these countries that I talked about that actually got us where we were. And I think that capacity is very, very critical. As an industry, as BHP Billiton, we don't deal a lot with trade and industry, ETI. We deal a lot, much more with DME. The only area where we deal with DTI is in respect to our own smelters. So, on an intra-African trade organization, you know, the forum that we talked about, I actually think it is important for another reason. On sustainability issue, as a member of BHP Billiton, I don't want to reach a point where I'm saying I'm better than Anglo-American. I only kill one person a year, Anglo kills 3 or 4. The reality, ironically, is that on all these issues of corporate citizenship, we all have to be the good. It's no good for me better than Anglo or Anglo being better than me. When you hear of 3 people dying in a mine, the first thing that comes to you is that the mining industry is a disaster. So I think you're quite right. In our own interest as business, we need to develop a less competitive and a more collaborative approach on these issues, because anybody who thinks the whole group, it's one time I cannot say to Anglo, your side of the boat is leaking. If it is leaking, we all go down together regardless of how safe my side of the boat was. And I guess the reason this hasn't happened, there are so many business forums. I mean, they take so much of my time. When I move out, I'm almost being paid for attending business forum meetings, and I'm thinking not of building more, but of cutting less. But that issue is very, very important. On coal and environment, 2 almost contrasting views. Anything that develops energy is so scarce. Everything that provides energy will always be in demand, and coal is one of them. And for me, the issue is not going to be how do you stop mining coal. The issue is going to be what technologies are you going to develop to manage the environmental impact of coal. And I think this is where the industry is going. Not mining less, but increasingly managing the environmental disasters. On workers and hostels, quite interesting, BHP Billiton was the first company to take a principled decision, and I'm answering 2 questions here, that we are totally abolishing hostels. And we have replaced them not with a housing allowance. We have replaced them with a bond allowance so that we force our staff to actually get into formal housing. Because we know the minute we give you a housing allowance, you just go to build another mukuku elsewhere. And what we are actually saying is, our staff should build the homes for other reasons too. Once you have built a home for the first time, you have an asset. Unfortunately, a mukuku might shelter you, but it's not a bankable asset. You can't put it on your balance sheet. And we actually insist that we will give you money to buy a proper house with a bond and so on. But in answer to another question, it also tells you that we tend to employ only from local communities. We no longer have migrant laborers. If they come, they are an exception rather than a rule. All our staff, whether in Mpumalanga or in the Northern Cape or wherever, is taken from local communities. Honorable Teko asked questions about investing purely for profit. No company will be allowed to do that today, even if we wanted to. Communities are alert, governments are alert, and NGOs are alert. There is only one sustainable strategy for businesses, what I alluded to as a win-win strategy. You have to demonstrate to communities. I mean, right now there's a deal where we are battling to move on because the community has dug in itself. I think that community is wrong, but that is besides the point. They are digging their heels in to say, wait a minute, you can't come here and throw your weight around. So that's okay. Even if I wanted to, let me tell you, on the ground, they won't allow me just to make a profit and run away. You can rest assured. If you don't do it for them, they will do it for you. So that is no longer, it used to be a big issue. It is no longer an issue. You have to deliver in a sustainable way. The world has changed. And most importantly, the only way to prevent that is through effective public policy. And this is where Parliament comes in making sure that there is effective legislation that business cannot simply grab and run. Thanks for the comment on the ACP and EU. They are very much valued. On the local people in Mpumalanga, I can give you my word of honor. We employ people only. I'm not saying only locally, but primarily locally. So that in any operation, you can assume that over 80% of employees are from the local communities. I cannot answer much on the Mozambique Sasol line. We were not involved in it. I'm not in a position to comment on that. On Zimbabwe, an investor, the first decision even before you go anywhere is how safe is my investment. And that is not an unusual decision. No consumer would buy a bread coupon if you thought that bakery was going to be blown before you get there to get the bread. It's just a common business. And so usually when you invest, the first thing you look is this a country where my investment is safe? Now, we as DHP Billiton are not involved in Zimbabwe for the simple reason that the kind of assets that are in Zimbabwe are not the ones that we are particularly interested in, not because they are in Zimbabwe. Even if they were in Zambia or Botswana, those are not the issues that we would be interested in. There is coal, but we have better quality coal in this country than in Mozambique. I mean, in a Zimbabwe, and there is also Platinum, and as a company we are not in Platinum. But Zimbabwe brings back the point I made earlier. No company would work in Zimbabwe with the aim of changing the political equation in Zimbabwe. It wouldn't. You don't even want to try. You are going to be blown to pieces. We think Zimbabwe requires a political solution, and it will require a regional solution. Where we can come in, it is adequate to come to us and say, listen, we have made headway here, and we think you can help us by underpinning your investment, which is actually what happened with our move into Mozambique. The South African government and the Mozambique government said, listen, we have come so far, but we think a major investment by a company of your size is going to turn the equation. And by the way, that was also the logic in the DRC. The DRC government felt very, very strongly that a company of our size will actually push the consolidation of democracy. But we could not work in ourselves on our own. We would really be blown to smithers. And we still love ourselves at that level.
Madam Chair, did I finish the presentation?
I don't want to give another presentation.
Did I the matter of trading blocks?
Trading blocks. They are an opportunity and a nightmare. And a good example, there's such an interest in Inga by everybody in SADC. And what are you getting there? One country saying, I desperately need energy. And another country saying, by the way, in whose country is this asset? So you do get those kinds of things. The competition between countries. Countries are like political parties. They are not always being driven by the same overriding concern. And I think our experience in all of this is that we should lobby where we can. I mean, in the industry, we dealt with the government of the DRC, but we also dealt with the energy company on which SADC was all presented, and there were tensions at times between us. And all I can say is there's no magic formula. All you have to do is to keep on pushing, because don't forget, we also don't come in as an objective player. Apart from government having their agenda, we also have our own. And I think it's a whole, you just have to use the methods we used in CODESA. We cajole each other, we swear at each other, but eventually we say, well, we have something on which we can work. There's no computer program for that. We just have to keep on slogging, making mistakes, but being driven by one overriding thing. You know, no rational government in SADC would not like Inga to succeed. And so we want Inga to succeed, and you take that as your starting point. You bring in what we can. We brought in what no government could easily bring without going through a parliamentary process. It took us not a long time just to sign 40 billion rand contribution to that. For a company of ourselves, it's a decision we can take by telephone. For parliament, you have, what is that law, the finance? PFMA. And so where we think PFMA is holding us back, we can come in and move things fast. It's that kind of interplay of what we have.
Thank you.
I just wanted to follow up on the answers that were given. One is that the very last one, Dr. Mampak. In the business day, the headline says, the Minister of Finance, it says, Trevor Manuel says South Africa should go alone on a free trade thing. You've just said that the trading blocks are sometimes a nightmare. What would be your view in the concept that we should consider South Africa going alone? I've not read the whole article, I've just seen the headline. That being the first issue, you then raise the fact that the quality of civil servants and the speed of delivery, meaning the turnaround of the response from government, Do you believe that given the nature of South Africa's structure, that your foreign trade is located between trade and industry, and your political side is handled by foreign affairs, will you then suggest that when we deal with issues of either foreign direct investment in our country and our companies moving abroad, are we able to give that turnaround, given the fact that the two components are functioning, the other one is a political aspect and the other one is more of a trade aspect, and they are located within two different ministries, and they are raising the fact that the turnaround is very important, and I'm saying, what do you think of that situation where we are sitting in two departments? Yesterday we were told that when business invests in any country, it's not there for charity. That's what we're told, that it's not there for charity. And I think members pick that up and say that yes, you're not asking for charity, but they're asking for engagement. And that you're saying that any business that goes to any country, purely driven by profit, that business is not on today's terms. Now, I'm trying to reconcile the two situation. You were told that when you move in an area, there will be social investment. However, business is not there for charity, it's there to make their money. That's basically the message. And you're saying, no. You need to balance that out with the community, because the community will then put it down. I'll ask for a comment on that. The other aspect we raised was the question of friendship amongst companies that come at a difficult time where countries need them. When a country goes to a business and say, we need you to come and invest, and you shun them at a time of need, we're told yesterday that that will count against you when things get normal. So you said earlier that no business wants to invest in an environment that is unstable. But we're told that in fact, in certain instances, you might have to go to that unstable environment. Because when things get normal, the ruling politicians there believe that when you came at a time of need, your most dependable friend than the one who will be coming when things are normal. The last point you raised, the fact that we run the country. And I agree with you that politicians do run the country. And therefore, in that instance, they have influence. But I'm not sure whether we should share the same view with Judge Seneca in this particular instance. That's all Elisha knows. Thank you.
Thank you.
I was asked a specific question about China. Now, it's very interesting. As BHP Billiton, we would view China in the same way that we view Anglo-American. Anglo-American is a major competitor to us. And at the same time, Anglo-American is a major partner to us in other things. For example, in manganese, it's a joint venture between Anglo-American and us. And in a mineral sense in Richards Bay, it's between Rio Tinto and us. And China is moving very, very strongly into resources. And to that extent, we will compete China as we have competed with everybody else. But on the other hand, if China wants to build infrastructure, why should I not celebrate that fact? Because it actually makes my investment even much easier. I think the key thing, and this government has been very, very strong on that issue, no foreign investor of any kind, whether it's China or the US, should be allowed unless there's a skills transfer. Otherwise, it's just another form of colonialism. It doesn't matter what it is. And so whether it's China coming in or BHP Billiton, you should stipulate what skills need to be transferred to local people and what, you know, the kind of BEE stuff that is required. I think it is a function of public policy, but we don't want to join this, view that China is a menace. China is not doing what other countries have not been doing for centuries and for things. It's simply a question that it must be guided by the same rules of sustainability that are required anywhere. Specifically on the last question, on the gold it alone, I also saw the headline, and as a company we have a policy, we don't even respond to newspaper reports. We would actually want to read the whole text of what the minister has said, because sometimes when you do that, you wonder where the journalist got the story, because the two don't go together. On DTI and foreign affairs specifically in respect to trade, I will answer it in two ways. As chairman of BHP Billiton, I will be fired for taking what is purely a political position. It would be, I will be told that the prerogative of the president, what you do, don't answer. And so I cannot answer that question as chair of BHP Billiton. But as the retired chair of the Presidential Review Commission, which President Mandela appointed in 1996, there was a specific recommendation by the Presidential Review Commission that the Department of Foreign Affairs should be renamed Ministry of Foreign Affairs and International Trade. I'm saying the commission has already made that recommendation to government. And what was the logic there? The logic was that foreign affairs historically, before the Cold War, was about bugging and spying and all of that, and that in the new order, foreign affairs is about promoting trade. That was the view, and that it needs to be able to facilitate that role. And no wonder all our successes outside were largely through foreign affairs, because they were on the ground, they could guide us, they knew who the players were, they told us where not even to go to. So as BHP Billiton, we have no position, but I could, if the Honorable Committee wants to revive the matter, the Presidential Review Commission is a good source. On charity and profit, maybe I came across as melodramatic, but the bottom line is no business goes there to make a loss. Actually, if you do that, the accountants will give you 2 or 3 years to make a loss, and they begin to tell you you are not a going business and you should fold. So business has to make a profit. All I am simply saying is, you cannot be a successful business if you don't take into cognizance national public policy objectives and if you do not take into process policy issues. If I moved into this country and I said I don't care what government wants, we want this profit, I know what GME is going to do to me. I know that very well. And if we moved into communities and we said, well, we are bringing bulldozers to smash your homes because we want to mine here, I know what the labor unions and what the NGOs and what communities are going to do. And therefore, I'm saying, in pursuing that enlightened self-interest, take everybody on board, but people don't come free of charge. You have to pay something to get people aligned to your goals. So I'm simply saying a win-win strategy is the only way you can maintain your profit. And I would also go to say, if you are not making profit, close your business, or it will close itself down.
Okay. there aren't any more questions, I think we'll just look at the way forward. I see the Dr. Mufai has proposed a formal forum. So I would like to ask you if you could possibly, how do you envisage this formal forum? How do you see
it? We did mention it last year. And what I would envisage in the beginning would be something very, very loose that could also involve using the current existing business. You know, you've got NDI, you've got business trust, where you already have cabinet ministers sitting. Well, maybe in the beginning of the year or in the meeting between the president and big business, just in the beginning of the year, getting a clearer picture that overall these are our objectives, but this year these are our priorities. Could you go back and come back to us and tell us where would you fit in our plans? And where I could come and say, these are my priorities on the continent. This is the kind of help I would appreciate from government, even if it's not as loosely as that. I'm always worried about beginning with very, very structured bodies in the beginning which get nowhere. There are many we can begin to raise those questions. For me, the key thing is what we need to get on the table through the existing forums is how do we begin to leverage each other's strengths. And there are strengths on both government and business. That would be my start. And maybe as we evolve, you can have much more specialized bodies, but I always worry about starting with specialized bodies when you have bodies there. But we don't know foreign policy issues. We only discover them when we walk on landmines in other countries.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mufai, for the very interesting presentation and the way you answered the questions of members. I do appreciate that. And members, I'd like to request if you have any ideas on how we can take this process forward. During the 2 days, we've raised a number of issues of how businesses behave in Africa, what is lacking, what is happening, and what ought to be happening. And today we heard another viewpoint on the social responsibility aspect of businesses that go into Africa. And a whole host of other things. Members have any ideas of how we see the way forward? If you have, please share them with us. And if not, then I think we will close this. Yes, Mr. Golden.
I think when we do our report, we'll probably go through a number of these areas. But one of the areas that maybe we need to indicate was the Dr. Mufai is still here, is that we've accepted the invitation to go to Mozambique. And it's only that we've not been able to find a good time. But my sixth sense tells me that members would most appreciate at the beginning of the year, either before the State of the Nation or just after the State of the Nation, we could be able to do that for that site visit. That's how we call it in Parliament, to do the site visit. But that will be probably the beginning of the year. And the fact that the current of the committee will probably communicate with yourself and your office on that particular aspect. But, Chairperson, I think having learned much of this areas and the participation of business in foreign policy, I think we need to pursue the issue of a form of a loose meeting. You know, at the beginning of the year, you have what we call ambassadors, heads of mission meetings. Maybe alongside that, we look at the meeting and we raise that. I know that the department is coming to the committee around the 7th. To do their annual report. Maybe we need to discuss that with them when they come to do their annual report. That's the first item. But I would say that what we may have to do at some point consider is to also look at our retail investors in the continent. because I think it generates a negativity as to how some of our big chain companies deal with things in the continent. I wouldn't want to name them, but I know that in wherever you go, they raise them. They tell you that insurance is doing that. I've just come back from Malawi now. There are issues that people will raise to say how particularly our chain stores relate with local people. So maybe I think that maybe we need to look at how we throw in our chain stores into the equation. I know that we did extend an invitation, although I must say at a late hour, to one or two of the chain stores. And it was too late for them. I accept that one. But maybe we need to look at how we do that. And probably they can come and share with us their own frustrations in those countries. Because there are two sides of the coin. It's not only South African business. And that to say to the committee that the governing party will be going to their national conference and they've spoken about the code of conduct that they want to put forward as part of their policy consideration. So we may have to look at that in the committee to say what does it mean. Not only for the governing party, but for the country should that such a policy be put forward. And probably look at it and say, is it what we want to see for our business people? Colleagues will remember that when we had the public hearing in Pretoria, one of the presenters or two of the presenters said to us that we should not go the route of the code of conduct. And maybe we need to come back and look at those issues at some point. So I would say that there are two probably tasks that emanate from this process. One is the fact that we need to get our retailers, particularly those who have a substantial number of shops in the continent, the ShopRite checkers, your game stores, and all those Steer Group and all those people, to come and talk to us and about those about their own understanding of the investment environment in different countries and what is it that they think we could do better. Because I want to say that there are two sides of the story. The complaints that we receive, we were told at some point that are generated by competitors at some point. That certain competitors who have been traditionally in those areas felt threatened by the South African move into their, what they would regard, their back doors. And they generated this resentment. Maybe it's a matter that we need to deal with it politically, how we assist our own investors in those communities. But we can only do that if we know exactly what are the issues. So when this complaint comes to us, we are able to give proper responses because they will have been connected with us. That will be the first step that I think we need to consider. The second one is to reflect on becoming code of conduct. What type of a code of conduct do we want to put in place? Taking into account that at the same time we do not want to make our companies uncompetitive on one hand, but then make sure that the code of conduct does advance both investment, but it takes into account the fact that as South Africans we are all expected to have just minimum values that all of us can defend and all of us can protect, and we are expected to behave in a particular way. And possibly the third aspect, it will be to further discuss whether the turnaround from public service, and in this particular case, our own Department of Foreign Affairs. Are we closer to our investing community? Do we understand their problems? How do we assist them? How do we provide assistance to them in making those decisions? And in fact, making sure that their operations in those countries are within what we regard as acceptable. So that even that behavior that becomes unacceptable, there should be a mechanism to feedback to say that we have company A and it's causing havoc. Because remember that the behavior of one company affects the country. It does not only affect that company. Because people are going to turn around and say South African companies and South Africans are like this. So it's not just a question of one company that is going to come out of that situation in a particular way. So we need to look at those issues and see how we deal with that. The other challenging issue that I think we need to reflect on is what was raised yesterday. that part of the resentment that we pick up in the continent is that the faith of investors in the continent is an issue. So maybe we need to come back and look at what does that mean. Dr. Mampai said that when they went to Mozambique, to Mozambique, they substantially the staff was from South Africa, and gradually they reduced that. They are now sitting at 90% local people. Are we doing the same thing in other businesses? Or do people find themselves as workers and all the managerial positions are all South Africans? And we do what was raised to us yesterday, that we then on Friday pick our bags, go home, and come back on Monday, and just to run the business and go back. So those are the questions that I think this process leaves us with, that we might have to come back and reflect on these processes. And I was going to suggest that maybe we should not do that now, but we have a slot where we need to look at our annual report. The 14th of November, where we need to look at our annual report. And I wanted to suggest that we do that reflection in that annual report of all these issues that are outstanding. And we then plan for ourselves the following year how we deal with them, and the following year how to erase them again when we deal with our program the following year. Thank you, Chief.
Yes, Mr. Savanda.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Only one thing which I wanted maybe to propose as an additional in our visit early next year. Chairperson, I was triggered about this proposal of the visit to Mozambique that we must include Quebec. The reason why I'm raising it is after the input from the ambassador which visited us from Iran, because we must be equipped in order to be able to defend and protect some of the gains which from the initiative which we have taken as a country to come up with that particular project, because it's not so popular, so that we can be on board, so that we can be able to disseminate information to other people as well. Why do we need such a project? Thank you.
Yeah, we shall certainly look at it as we draft the program for next year. Comrades and friends, this is the end of this session. I think it's 2 days of beginning to understand what big business is about and what big business does in Africa and the rest of the world. It gives us a better idea. And also, I think Mr. Chitone is quite correct when he says we need to reflect on what kind of strategy we can present as to how big business can work together constructively with government and with parliament. I just want to pick up on one point that Dr. Mapai said about doing Madiba's fine, that I thought it would be a good idea if the foreigner, Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade, something like that. I think at some time, I know that in foreign affairs, there is more and more, especially in the foreign missions, there's more stress laid on how we promote trade and investment in Africa and the rest of the world. However, there is a problem in the sense that Department of Trade and Industry and Foreign Affairs should be, ought to be, and are beginning to work closer on that, because I think a quality product can only come about if the two departments really interact with each other to promote. You said that you work mostly with Foreign Affairs and not with Trade and Industry. So those are the kind of things that we also need to look at. How I know there is a cluster program, and And but I think so that many, when you go into our missions abroad, many of our personnel in those missions aren't really au fait with the aspect of how to promote foreign trade and investment in that particular country. So we do have weaknesses in our missions, and I think we need to recognize it and see how we can assist. With that, friends and comrades, there's lunch waiting outside. Once again, so I thank Dr. Rabai. Thank you very much for coming again and presenting to us, Wilkinson, and all of you for coming. Thank you.